Today I have a few remaining things to talk about at the end of chapter 7, and we'll, I believe, have time to get started on chapter 8 about waveguides and resonant cavities. I think more or less where I ended last time was we had finished the derivation of these pretty remarkable Kramers-Kronig relations. The way I often see them used is that one easy thing that to measure experimentally in the laboratory, although it might require different techniques for different frequency ranges, you can measure the absorption of light by a medium. And that gives you, as a function of frequency, the imaginary part of the dielectric constant. And if you have it, if you've obtained it at all frequencies, you can just do this integral and you've got the real part then, which tells you things like the dispersion, how light is bent, Snell's applied in Snell's law, for instance, tells you the phase of an oscillating dipole moment created by a laser pulse. I'll give you a reference to some ideas where this sort of analysis has been used. But to illustrate it, I think one useful starting point is to look at a narrow absorption line. So let's look at an example of a narrow absorption line. And I have in mind here something like a two-level system between two bound states. So for that, you might approximate the absorption as pi times a constant over twice the frequency times the Dirac delta function. Omega minus omega naught. And then the integral is very easy to do. And you immediately get that the real part of epsilon of omega then will look like that constant k over omega naught squared minus omega squared plus some kind of smooth background contribution that I won't try to specify in any more detail. So this is like the resonant part. There might be smooth stuff in the absorption as well. And if you look then at what these look like, the imaginary part, of course, of this epsilon over epsilon naught function of omega will have some peak centered at omega naught. And the real part will also have a feature at centered at omega naught. But it will look typically more like well, it's this simple pole you see in the formula. You have a simple pole. In reality, there will usually be some damping that makes it connect sort of like this. So it doesn't really diverge all the way to infinity on the positive and negative sides of omega naught. So this is very characteristic. This happens all the time. If one of these has a symmetric-ish profile, the other, like the, the other will tend to have this asymmetric line shape. And another example, something kind of reflecting the same physics, is there's a famous paper by Fano. It's actually like one of the citation classics. It's for how many times it's been cited in the literature. It's a Fizrev. The reference is in the notes, but let me write it here. 1961 article, which is an improved version of a paper he wrote when he was sort of working with the Fermi group in the 1930s in Rome, where he looked, instead of going between two bound states, like a ground state and an excited bound state, he was considering a case like helium, where you have a 1s squared state, and you go with a photon way up above the ionization potential, ionization energy, which is the energy of the helium plus ground state, way up here, around 60 eV photon energy, something like that. There's the first doubly excited state that you see in the photoabsorption spectrum. And it's not just photoabsorption, it's actually photoionization. So you're actually kicking out, you're creating this ion plus an electron when you probe this energy range. But if this resonance wasn't here, you might just see a smooth cross section. But because there is this resonance, the absorption, which is giving us the imaginary part of epsilon of omega, near this resonance, I'll call that omega naught 2, also at this frequency of this autoionizing state. Now Fano showed you get an asymmetric line shape in the imaginary part. And so as you might imagine, you can do the integral for the real part. And what you see is something more symmetric and kind of simple. So it's kind of the reverse situation of photoabsorption at a bound state. This is sometimes called the funnel line shape, this asymmetric line shape, but it's really basically the same math relating the imaginary and the real parts that we had with the bound state. One other paper I might mention, it's actually a paper I co-authored in Science, 347/16 in 2013, one of my higher cited papers, with collaboration with the Heidelberg group of Thomas Pfeiffer, was looking actually at this same transition and showing that because of this Kramers-Kronig relation, if you know the imaginary part of the dipole, basically from the photoionization cross-section, you can predict the real part, and you can get the whole phase of an oscillating dipole. In particular, this paper was focused on an ultra-fast application of that, where you like hit the atom with a laser pulse. It's almost a delta function now in time. And that sets this dipole moment oscillating to this autoionizing state. And basically, there will be some phase relative to having a sine wave that starts at the origin. And using this Kramers-Kronig type analysis, you could predict the phase in time, the phase shift of this wave. So that got kind of popular. A lot of papers have cited that, not as many as Fano's paper, but quite a few. Okay, so that's, I think, all I wanted to say about Kramers-Kronig. I think in the homework you get an opportunity. Why doesn't that go off? That light is kind of annoying. Oh, and speaking of homework, I have office hours tomorrow, you might remember from the syllabus, and I might be a little late coming back from an off-campus lunch I have to attend, but just come a little later if I'm not there. So one thing we are going to be moving into is electromagnetic waves in conductors. I was going to cover that next, but I should do the slow light example first. Maybe I'll change the order of my notes a little here. Yeah, this is more related to what I was just talking about. So this is sort of an exotic example that was kind of a sensation in the physics community back in around 1999. A paper by Lena Howe's group at Harvard published in Nature. And it has something like 2,000 citations. This, I guess, I called an appendix to lecture one in the lecture notes directory. So here the idea is you have a gas of three-level atoms. Of course, the gas has more levels. It's just that the laser frequencies are tuned to the transition so that only three levels you need to think about. And I think this was actually for a sodium atom. And so the idea is you have like maybe a ground state, we'll call it state one, which for sodium would be the 3s state. There is a second state of the same parity as state one, but which, so these are not electric dipole connected. But then there's a third state of opposite parity. And the idea is to dress this transition between levels two and three by what's called a dressing laser, which basically changes the Hamiltonian of this system by kind of creating a mixture of states two and three with monochromatic radiation. So you have H bar omega 2, 3 are the energy of these photons that are dressing these two energy levels. And by doing this, you're changing the index of refraction of the system for a probe state laser, a probe laser tuned to this frequency, omega, in the vicinity of omega 1, 3. Okay. So when you turn off this laser, you'll just see a standard dispersion profile for the index of refraction of this gas. So it would look like the usual real part, epsilon over epsilon naught, starting at one, and then it might have a standard anomalous dispersion. Remember, anomalous dispersion is when you get a negative derivative with respect to omega of the real part. So this would be centered on omega 1, 3, and the imaginary part, the absorption, will show a more or less symmetric peak at that same frequency. It's a function of omega. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what you have probably heard about is the Outler-Towns doublet. It sort of makes these states doubled. You set this up as a two-level system with a constant frequency. You'll get a 2x2 Hamiltonian, and you'll get two quasi-energy states. That's roughly what's going on. Actually, in the notes, I guess I was going to write that next. So you can think of the now what the dressing does. It creates a, we'll call a dressed state, which has two linear combinations. You can think of this way. Like, let's say there is some number of photons at frequency h bar omega 2, 3 times the atomic matter state of the atom state 3, and then you'll have two eigenstates when you're exactly on resonance, and that will, because that's going to be degenerate with having one more photon. At h bar omega 2, 3 for the photon field and atom state number 2. So these are like the eigenstates of these two levels I sketched. And they're split by the Rabi frequency. Is proportional to the electric field in the laser, which I'll call 2 delta here.
The name of Rabi was eluding me. I couldn't remember it on this spot. I was trying to relate to that, but I just couldn't.
Okay, so this became that, sort of, split by 2 delta. And that's what's sometimes called an Outler-Towns doublet. If any of you take the AMO course this semester with Francis, you'll hear about stuff like that. Okay, and so this changes the dielectric constant of the gas. And I wrote a fairly complicated formula in the notes that came from that paper, which I guess I need to write. Which has this structure. Now I have a parameter S, which I don't remember what it is. I guess something like the oscillator strength. You get 1, 3. Maybe I won't write this. It's in the notes. It's not really all that informative. But you get resonant denominators and the imaginary. There's this state has a lifetime. These excited state 3 have a lifetime in the absence of the dressing, which is in those formulas. But let me just instead sort of talk graphically to get the main physics across and plot the real part of epsilon of omega over epsilon naught to show you what's most interesting is what happens in the actual gas in the experiment. Okay, here's one. So you now get sort of a doubled line shape with the splitting being the Outler-Towns doublet. centered at omega 1, 3. And now, if you remember that the group velocity of a pulse, now that you want to send through such a gas, we derive to be the speed of light over the index of refraction plus omega times the derivative. Okay. You could get a point of very large positive derivative, which makes the denominator very big. Depends on how big this spacing is, but especially if this is a small spacing, then this derivative in this region, which I didn't sketch real well, so it looks a little more like that, that derivative can get quite large, and if you make a wave packet centered on that region, you can get a very slow pulse going through the medium. Moreover, that wouldn't be all that useful if there was a big absorption at that point, because the light pulse would just immediately dissipate in the medium and you'd lose everything. But what's interesting about this scenario is when you look at the imaginary part in this energy range, you get two peaks, but with an almost perfect destructive minimum of zero at the center, right at the point where the light, where this derivative is biggest. So I didn't draw it real well, but these are more or less lined up. And so if you look at the transmission through a gas, like have a gas cell that you've dressed with this dressing laser, and you send in a laser pulse and watch it go through the medium, like that example I did showed with the Coke bottle one or two lectures ago, I guess last lecture. You see the pulse going through the medium. You can measure the transmission and that will at this omega 1, 3, it will peak because the absorption got so small at that point. And at other frequencies, like here where the imaginary part is large, the light doesn't get through to the other side of the gas cell. But again, calculate this velocity in the Howe experiment. They could make a light pulse travel at 17 meters per second, about the speed of a bicycle, through this medium. Why you'd need that, what it would be useful for, I don't know. But they were actually doing this experiment in a Bose condensate, but it was later shown, I think Misha Lukin was on that paper, which showed you can see the same effect. You don't need a Bose condensate. You can do this in a thermal gas as well. Yeah, I think you could call it that. Yeah. Electromagnetic induced transparency is what EIT is. It's one of the big quantum optics effects of occurring in these types of three-level systems. Okay, so one last little bit about Chapter 7. It's kind of a prelude, which some ideas are going to be needed in Chapter 8, is electromagnetic waves in conductors. Who was that? Okay. So we can also say this more generally. We're talking about materials with imagine for simplicity a constant value but complex of epsilon and mu. And let's look at the Maxwell equations, still in SI units. We'll be in SI units until about chapter 11. So we still have several weeks of SI units. Okay, so we're talking about a linear medium. And because epsilon is constant, we can write the Maxwell equations. Del dot E is rho free over epsilon. Del dot B is still zero. Curl of E is minus dB dt. And curl of B is mu sigma E plus mu epsilon dE dt. And moreover, we'll assume we have an ohmic conductor. So J is a conductivity sigma times E. If we take now the curl of this equation, we have the curl of E, which is del dot E minus del squared E. A lot of hungry students want this classroom. Is minus d by dt. And plug in for the curl of B, minus d by dt. Of mu sigma E plus mu epsilon dE dt. And we get the following equations. Del squared E is mu sigma dE dt plus mu epsilon d squared E dt squared. So we have a wave equation for the electric field, and I should say the same equation you can quickly derive for B, exact same equation. With only difference from what we're used to seeing, there's this extra first derivative term. Okay. And so, like we analyzed solutions of the wave equation before, let's do the same type of analysis on a generic component. This applies to either E or B. Take one component and look at the plane wave solution structure. So I'll call it U of X and T. Of either of those equations. And look at a 1D, one-dimensional plane wave solution. Just to get the kind of qualitative behavior. So d squared u of xt dx squared is mu sigma du dt plus mu epsilon d squared u dt squared. And we have a simple homogeneous PDE. So it's often useful to try an exponential solution. Some amplitude u naught times plane wave. And And plugging this in, you quickly get minus k squared u naught times that exponential has to equal minus I omega mu sigma minus omega squared mu epsilon times u naught e to the I kx minus omega t. And so the bottom line is this, for this model, you have derived directly the dispersion relation between k and omega, namely k squared, which controls the wave number in the spatial direction, is related to the frequency and the time, omega by k squared is omega squared mu epsilon. This we're used to seeing, but now there's an additional term, I mu sigma omega, that makes it imaginary. And this is often rewritten this way, k as the square root of all that, omega squared mu epsilon plus I mu sigma omega to the 1/2, which we could break up into a real and an imaginary part. And we usually choose the branch of this square root such that kr is positive and ki is normally greater than or equal to zero. So if we plug that back into our initial wave, you see that ki will be non-zero if sigma is non-zero, if the conductivity in the medium is non-zero, or if the imaginary part of epsilon mu is non-zero. Okay. And in that case, if either of those is true, then the wave will show an attenuation as the wave moves into this conducting medium. It will look like u naught e to the minus the imaginary part of k times x, can separate that out, and then times a normal oscillating plane wave just with the real part of the wave number. So that's the main point of that derivation, is to show that there is attenuation governed by this imaginary part. And we'll be seeing a lot more about that type of attenuation, the effects of it. And that leads to the skin depth of the waves in a conductor, which is important if you have a waves now going through a waveguide, like we'll be talking about in Chapter 8. Okay. You can go further and talk about waves diffusing through the conducting medium. And actually that language is discussed in, let me add this to your reading assignment in addition to reading Chapter 8. Especially for next lecture, read those, the first half at least of Chapter 8. You should probably also review Jackson's section 518, which is pages 218 to 221 about waves in such media. All right. So, chapter 8. We're talking now about sort of two related scenarios, one of which is a waveguide, which you could think of as usually some kind of a conducting material that we're going to send, which is hollow, you're going to send a wave through it. And a related thing called a resonant cavity, which is basically the same thing, except you make the end caps conductors. So the wave bounces around inside. That changes a waveguide into a resonant cavity, in which you'll have some characteristic resonant frequencies where the light really wants to exist at those frequencies. So we're going to look at electromagnetic waves going through such media. And the first step in that is to understand that a really crucial point is to spend a lot of time understanding the boundary conditions of the waves at the surface of the of this conducting material. And we're going to look at this in two stages. We're going to first look near a perfect conductor, idealized perfect conductor. And qualitatively, when you see these words, really, any time in this course, you see the words perfect conductor, what should spring into your mind is that the electrons are just, or the charges in general, are just totally free to move to respond instantly to any applied fields. And because of that, all fields are zero in a perfect conductor. So that's just like we expected. We saw that in electrostatics. This is true more generally now, even with time-varying fields. After we discuss what happens for a perfect conductor, we'll look at what happens for a realistic conductor, which has, you know, maybe high conductivity, but not perfect conductivity, not infinite conductivity. But we have to understand this first by looking at all the boundary conditions. Okay. So if we imagine a surface, like with here's a conductor, here's maybe vacuum. We're going to be interested in how the fields change near how they're related inside and outside the conductor. Of course, we could have surface charges. I'm going to use capital sigma for surface charges because we're going to reserve for little sigma the conductivity. And we know that the surface charges will obey at the surface d dot n hat is capital sigma, where d is the electric displacement just outside the conductor, and we have a normal unit vector pointing out of the conductor, a away from the surface, normal to the surface. Right, normally this would be d out minus dn would be dot, but dn is zero. As we said, all the fields are zero in the conductor. So that'll give us one of our key things we're going to keep track of. We're going to write all the important boundary conditions. Similarly, in a perfect conductor, surface currents can be generated essentially to respond so freely in a perfect conductor. And so if you have an H, a magnetic field vector just outside, right? Normally you would say N cross H, my outside minus N cross H inside would be equal to the surface current. But now the H inside is zero, so we just simply have another boundary condition on the H field, the magnetic field, just outside the conductor. The parallel components to the surface, parallel components of H have to equal the whatever surface current is there. K is our surface current. And again, H is just outside. All the fields in I'll be writing are outside. Of course, then I'll use C subscript for the fields in the conductor. All of these are zero. And we have some other boundary conditions that have to hold at the surface because of del dot B is zero. That means the normal components of B are, of course, continuous. And the parallel components of E have to be continuous. This continuity of the normal components of B means that the normal component of B has to be zero just outside the conductor. And similarly, E cross N hat, which will pick up parallel components of E just outside. Parallel components of E have to be zero also. Okay. So, stated in words, okay, outside a conducting perfect medium surface, the E field has to be normal to the surface. So only E perpendicular to the surface is non-zero. And the H field must be parallel or tangential to the surface. H parallel. These are the key components of the field that can be non-zero outside this perfect conductor. So if we sketch as a function of some coordinate approaching the surface, sketch all the fields components, we get a graph that I'll try to sketch now. So here I'll draw either E or H components as a function of a coordinate that I'm going to approach a surface. This dotted dashed line will be the surface, and that is the point I'm going to call C equals 0. And so going into the conductor, this is the conductor side, where C is greater than 0. And this is the vacuum side, where C is less than 0. So the way I've drawn it, n hat is pointing in the negative C hat direction. Okay, so here all the fields are 0 inside, so I can just draw a 0 for all fields. And if there is a perpendicular component of H, whatever it is, it has to go to 0 at the surface. And if there is some parallel component of E outside in the vacuum, as you get closer and closer to the surface of the perfect conductor, that has to go to 0 and remain 0 inside the conductor. On the other hand, if you come in with like a perpendicular component of E field, it comes in to a finite value. If there are surface charges, this value will be non-zero. And then, of course, it has to drop instantaneously to 0 inside the conductor, this perfect conductor. And if H has a parallel component coming in, this can be non-zero. And if it is, it implies there are surface currents. A two-dimensional surface current line exactly on the surface of the conductor. And then that has to drop instantly to 0 going into the conductor once you're into the bulk. Okay, so that's kind of the zeroth order picture of what the fields do near a conductor surface. Of course, it's not fully realistic because conductors don't have normally infinite conductivity, except maybe if it's a superconductor, it might be a pretty close approximation to that. So next, let's talk about a good but imperfect conductor, how this all changes. So inside a real conductor, all fields, as we derived a minute ago, are attenuated. They had that exponential decay I wrote due to the imaginary part of the wave number. And there is a characteristic distance of that attenuation. And that distance is called the skin depth of the conductor. And we'll use the symbol delta for that. That will come into a lot of our formulas in this chapter, which derives from the imaginary part of that wave number. It's inverse, 2 over mu c omega sigma conductivity there to the 1/2. If that's a small number, which you'll get if you have a high conductivity, then you'll get a very fast decay. Okay. So our starting point for understanding this situation is sort of based on this initial zeroth order picture for a perfect conductor. So our starting assumption is that as you approach the surface of the conductor, there will be this normal electric field component outside and a parallel component of the H field outside. But now we're going to change one part of that picture, which is that there exists also a normal EC field just inside, which will be attenuated and quickly go to zero over a distance of the skin depth. That's what we're expecting. And there is a tangential H field in the conductor. Just inside. Okay. We're only treating here monochromatic fields pretty much through just about this whole chapter. Both the fields and sources. Again, we call that the monochromatic case. And we can look at Maxwell equations to see what the fields are going to look like as you move to increasing C going into the conductor. And there's a sort of a transition region from C to a distance of the order of delta of the skin depth, over which you'll be interested in how the fields behave over that tiny length scale. It's usually quite tiny, again, for a good conductor. Okay, so let's look at the equations in the conductor. Curl of H is J, which is sigma times the E field in the conductor. This, of course, neglects the Maxwell displacement current. This is usually small, and it's easier to see why it's small in Gaussian units, because there's like a 1 over the speed of light in this term. So For very high frequencies, that might be called into question. But for low frequencies, like microwaves, which is what you're often talking about, microwaves maybe, in a typical waveguide, that's a really good approximation. So this we can solve right away for the E field in the conductor then is approximately 1 over the conductivity times curl of H in the conductor. It's one key equation. And H in the conductor is minus I over mu in the conductor, magnetic permeability in the conductor, times omega curl of E in the conductor. Okay. And if you think of, we're trying to think what happens as you come near the conductor surface, the thing that's changing the most in the fields is going to be the normal component. Because, right, if you've got this conductor, then you're moving along a line. Right, here's the vacuum again. Here's the conductor. Things change suddenly as you move along this line only in this direction. They aren't changing much at all as you move. Of course, they would if it was a very weird conductor shape like a point, but we're not really thinking about that. More of a smooth parallel coordinate. So what we can do is approximate the gradient operator accordingly as simply minus n hat d by dc. Does that make sense? So in other words, we neglect the parallel derivatives. Then these equations we had there can be written as the E field in the conductor minus 1 over sigma n hat cross dhc dc, which I'm calling equation 1 in the notes. And H in the conductor is I over mu c omega for these monochromatic fields. N hat cross the c derivative of the electric field in the conductor, which I called equation 2 in the notes. So what I'm going to do next is solve these equations. And the first step in doing that, I'm going to take n hat cross this equation, n hat cross h. So n hat cross h in the conductor is I over mu c omega n hat cross d by dc. Now for ec, I'm going to plug it in from equation 1, d by dc minus 1 over sigma n hat cross dhc dc. Which I can also rewrite the right-hand side as minus I over mu c omega sigma d squared dc squared of n hat cross hc. So we have a second derivative. If I just look at this equation, we've got a second derivative is equal to a constant times the quantity itself, n hat cross hc, which are the parallel components of the field inside the conductor. I know you're saying to yourself, just why are you telling me this stuff about boundary conditions? But we really, that controls everything we're going to do in the next several lectures. These boundary conditions underpin almost everything. Okay, so now I think I'm multiplying by minus I mu c omega sigma and get a more standard form of the equation that we're used to looking at. We're solving for the parallel components of the magnetic field in the conductor. Right, when you take a cross product, you're only picking up the components that are orthogonal to both vectors. And assuming the normal components are going to be zero. They came into the perfect conductor zero, so we're not considering them. And now this constant in front can also be written as 2i over delta squared. Right, it has to be 1 over length squared. C is the length moving into the conductor. So we have to have this term 1 over length squared, and of course that length is the skin depth. So we can solve this differential equation in our sleep. I'll write the solution this way, that H in the conductor will be H equal H parallel outside times e to the I times I mu c omega sigma to the 1/2 times C. Here we have this I to the 1/2. I'll remind you how to calculate that. I like to write I as e to the I pi over 2. Then we have to take the square root of that. So we get e to the I pi over 4. And so this will be cosine pi over 4 plus I sine pi over 4. I think that's Euler's formula. And so one way to write that is 1 plus I over root 2. And so this H in the conductor will also then, I can write it as H parallel. Again, this is the outside H coming up to the surface. It will continue to oscillate as you move into the conductor, but it is damped by the imaginary part of this wave number, e to the minus c over the skin depth. So that's Hc, H in the conductor, and again H parallel is the vacuum parallel component. And again, delta, did I already write delta somewhere? Delta is root 2 over mu c omega sigma. Then we can come back to this equation for EC, equation 1, and get the electric field in the conductor. C omega over 2 sigma to the 1/2 1 minus I n hat cross H parallel e to the I C over delta. It also has an oscillating part and a damped part, e to the minus C over delta. So this is also a component parallel to the surface, right? Because cross product will be orthogonal again to both vectors. So this E in the conductor will be right angles to H at the surface and orthogonal to this and parallel to the surface. So I'm ready about to, not quite ready to make a graph. We should talk about the normal components, like of the E field. This is an aside in Jackson. I think it's a footnote. On page 355, that there is an EC dotted into the normal surface unit vector, which is of order I omega epsilon over the conductivity times E perpendicular. But this is order of magnitude smaller, and it's often neglected. So in most of our discussion, this will be neglected, this EC dot n hat, following the logic of Jackson development in this chapter. Basically, one order of magnitude smaller than the E parallel that we derived over there. Right. So I have parallel. All right. And then there's also a relation between, if we look at the surface, I tried to sketch this in the notes, but this is a hard thing to sketch. Again, this is vacuum, and this is conductor. And here's some coming along some line that goes to the normal, outward normal from the conductor, that there will be an H parallel and at right angles coming in an E parallel in the vacuum. And then if I look a little bit inside the conductor here, there will be an H in the conductor, and there will be an E in the conductor, something like that, which are continuing to oscillate as I go deeper in the conductor and damped. And E parallel just outside the conductor has to be related to H outside the conductor by mu C omega over 2 sigma to the 1 half times 1 minus I n hat cross H parallel, instead of being zero, like we found here. This E parallel is going to actually come down to a non-zero value by virtue of the fact that there is an H parallel coming in, typically larger at this surface. The one implication of that is that there will be energy flow into the conductor. So we can calculate that, which is a really important quantity. Call that the differential rate of power loss from the radiation field just outside per unit area. This is because it's time averaged, we do the usual trick of taking one half the real part of one field conjugated and one field not conjugated. And so that will be the normal component of the cross product of E parallel with H parallel conjugated. I need the real part of that, which is one half the real part of mu C omega over 2 sigma to the 1 half times 1 minus I absolute value of H parallel squared, because the E parallel we know from H parallel. And working out that algebra, and I'll skip a couple of steps of that simplifying algebra, you get mu in the conductor, omega, and can write it in terms of the skin depth, delta, over 4 times H parallel squared. So you can see one kind of thing that we're kind of pointing to is that H parallel is controlling sort of everything. And so often we'll just mostly, when we need to know things like the power loss in the conductor, because we're working with monochromatic fields, we can just focus on the parallel surface components of H. Okay, so now I'm ready to contrast the perfect conductor with the realistic good conductor and show the generalization of this graph on the left. But as we're going on next lecture or two or three, these relations we've derived today are going to be pulled up again and again. You might even want to have a summary sheet that summarizes those boundary conditions. Okay, so this was the perfect conductor over here. Here's a real conductor, similar diagram. Here is the surface at C equals 0. Now we'll have some H parallel coming in. We will have some E perpendicular coming in. H perpendicular coming in and E parallel coming in. Now they won't go instantly to zero the way they did here in the perfect conductor. But now the H parallel, which controls most of this, it will start decaying exponentially, but with an oscillation. So it'll have this kind of a decay on top of an oscillation, because you had both a real and an imaginary part of the wave number. Okay. So this is H parallel in the conductor. And E perpendicular is still going, we're going to approximate it as going instantly to zero, although this footnote in Jackson shows it's not exactly zero, but it's an order of magnitude smaller. And then there's the E field in the conductor, which is also going to be damped over the same length scale and oscillate. And then there is H perpendicular in the conductor, which also goes to zero over the skin depth. It is very small at the boundary, but not zero. So that is now our more realistic picture. And this is a sort of transition region as you go into the conductor of the size of the skin depth is the range of delta C, over which, beyond which you can basically neglect these fields. I guess I'm out of time. Sorry, I went over a couple minutes. We'll take it from there and start looking at the waves next time in the waveguides.